I know this is a bit of a strange situation, but I would kind of welcome if people have questions, then don't hesitate to ask. I will also kind of, I know, make some pauses in the middle of this. Yeah, I'm very happy to be here at Perimeter, although under like slightly strange circumstances. I'm very thankful to PI that they set this up, this virtual conference. So thank you all for being here virtually. I will present some results on LDPC quantum codes. The structure of the talk will be as follows. I will first kind of remind everyone of some background. So maybe not everybody is very familiar with quantum error correction. So I will introduce what are LDPC and topological quantum codes. I will, in particular, highlight how we can exploit geometry to construct these codes. I will then kind of use this to talk about the construction of 4D hyperbolic codes, which is a class of codes which was introduced by two mathematicians, Larry Guth and Alex Lobotsky, which has interesting properties, which we will discuss, but which are non-trivial to construct. And then I will discuss some results on decoding these codes using a very simple but yet very effective decoding methods called belief propagation, which is very common in classical error correction. And then I will talk a bit about like some preliminary results, which is kind of inspired by this work. So this is a method to reduce the weight of the checks that we have to perform. So the weight of the measurement that we have to perform in order to do error correction with LDPC codes. Okay, so let's get started. I don't think I have to sell you on the importance of quantum computation, or like I have to kind of get you excited about it. Certainly a big hindrance in building these devices is the presence of noise. In particular, arbitrary shifts can kind of interfere with the state of the quantum computer. But there's an important observation, which is that measurements discretize the continuous errors. In particular, Peter Shor in 95, counting some critics, some criticism, showed that it is possible to correct errors in a quantum computer. The vehicle to do this are quantum error correcting codes. Shortly after, Aronoff and Ben-Orr, and previously also some other related work, proved the threshold theorem, which essentially says that there exists a threshold of some parameter which characterizes the noise, such that if the error rate per gate and time step is below this parameter or below the threshold, then arbitrary long quantum computations are possible with having only a modest overhead. I will quickly go through like a very small toy example for people who have never seen this before. So let's consider +1 eigenstates of two Pauli Z-type operators. So one is acting as Z on the first and the second qubit, and one on the second and the third qubit. And let's consider the +1 eigenstates, which are 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. And I will call these the logical states, so states which encode a single qubit. If an error happens, an x-type error happens on the first qubit, so we apply an x1, then the first qubit flips and it maps 0, 0, 0 to 1, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1 to 0, 1, 1. What now happened is that we changed the eigenvalue of the first operator, but left the second one invariant. And these I will call parity checks or stabilizers. It's a very simple exercise to kind of see that if the X error happened on either none of the qubits or the physical qubits or like some one of the other ones, then by measuring these two checks, we can infer where the error happened and undo it. Most importantly, we can do this without actually disturbing the encoded degree of freedom. Okay, and this somewhat trivial example can be extended to something which actually protects a single qubit against an arbitrary error. Gottesman, shortly after Shor, actually gave a framework how to kind of construct these codes, and this is called the Stabilizer formalism. I will not kind of go through the details of this, but I want to highlight two important facts which you hopefully keep in mind. One is that the check measurements need to commute. This is because we just want a well-defined outcome, right? If we would kind of measure something which is non-commutative, which wouldn't commute, then we would kind of change the outcome and we would kind of lose track of the information. And the second one is that the number of encoded qubits can be derived by this very simple equation. We just kind of take the number of physical qubits and subtract the number of independent checks which they have to fulfill, which are given by the stabilizers or by the checks. One important special case are so-called CSS codes. And these are those where all checks are either completely of X type or of Z type, which means that they act as poly X or as poly Z on their support. In this special case, what one can do is one can visualize the code in form of a graph. So this is a three-level graph with the qubits in the middle, and the Z checks on top and the X checks on the bottom. And there's an edge between a check and a qubit, if and only if the qubit is in the support of the check. So for example, this check would be Z1, Z2, Z3. I would also like to mention that this is actually not such a special case, because in fact, any stabilizer code can be mapped onto a CSS code, preserving most of its properties. Remember this this condition that we had to fulfill, that the checks commute. This translates into this graph in the following way. So the neighborhoods of the Z and the X checks need to have an even overlap. And the very famous example of this code is Kitaev's toric code, where we imagine a torus with a square tiling. And we place qubits on the edges of this tiling. And we identify the faces with the Z checks and the vertices with the X checks in the sense that a single face kind of acts on all its adjacent edges, which are the qubits. And similarly, we look at all the edges incident to a vertex. And this gives us our X check. Again, we can kind of view this as such a graph. So this tiling defines this graph, where again, the Z checks are the faces and the X checks are the vertices and the qubits are on the edges. Now you can kind of convince yourself that if you have look at such a tiling, then any face and vertex share either zero or two edges. This means that if we take, I don't know, two checks here, then the neighborhoods will have even overlap. So for example, this one and this one, they overlap on these two guys. And so this defines a valid quantum code. What about the logical degrees of freedom? So first of all, they must commute. Let's only look at the Z logical operators, so the ones which act as Z on the encoded qubit. So this certainly must commute with all X checks. So there must be a closed loop. However, if it is a contractible loop on the surface of the torus, then it's a product of the Z checks. And we already said that these will be plus one eigenstates, so this has a trivial action on the logical degrees of freedom. So therefore, the logicals are non-contractible loops, of which the torus has two. Namely, this one, and then the one going the other way around. Okay. One property that codes can have is that they are low-density parity check codes, which means that the size of the support of each check is bounded, and each qubit is included in a bounded number of checks. And this is certainly important because if you want to have consider larger and larger code families to have better and better error protection, if you want to kind of run longer and longer algorithms, then we don't want the check weight to grow with the size of the code. Because it would be very hard to build such a thing physically. First of all, certainly if the checks are local in some geometry, like in the example that we just seen, then it's certainly LDPC. So any constructions of these type are LDPC. There are some other quantities that we can judge a quantum code by, namely its encoding rate, so the ratio of encoded degrees of freedom versus like physical resource. So this is like the bang for the buck that you get. The distance, which is the support of a logical operator, meaning how many errors do I have to accumulate to kind of actually do something on the logical degree of freedom. We certainly want some efficient decoding algorithm. So once we have obtained the measurement outcome, we want to be able to infer the most or a likely or a good recovery procedure to kind of counter the effect of the error. The threshold, which is a noise parameter of the noise under below which we can suppress errors. The number of qubits in each check, so the weight of the check that we have to facilitate, and the logical gates that we can perform. Okay. Many or several LDPC quantum code family are known. So there are ones which are constructed from 2D 2D tilings, the surface code and the color code. One of them is close relative to the Torrey code we just saw. There are 3D Euclidean codes, which are interesting because they have a large number an easy way to implement gates. And then there are codes which have a linear encoding rate, by which I mean the number of encoded degrees of freedom grows linearly with the number of physical qubits. Yeah, there are 2D hyperbolic codes, hypergraph product codes, and 4D hyperbolic codes. So the reason why we would kind of care about these linear rate codes is a result by Gottesman, which tells us that LDPC codes with a linear rate, good error correcting capabilities, and an efficient decoder, then we can do quantum fault tolerance with constant overhead. So the overhead doesn't even grow if we want to do longer computations. And it was shown by Fazi and others recently that this can actually be achieved using this code family. But in my talk, I will focus on these guys, these 4D hyperbolic codes. They were first introduced by two mathematicians, Guth and Lubotsky, in 2014. And their motivation was actually to disprove a conjectured bound on parameters that homological codes can have. And I will define what homological means in a second. So this bound essentially says that the number of encoded degrees of freedom, or encoded qubits, times the distance squared has to be upper bounded by n up to some, let's say, subpolynomial corrections, so some log factor or something. And it's known that this actually holds for 2D codes, which was shown by Delfos. And they disproved this conjecture by showing that 4D hyperbolic codes actually have parameter scaling k scaling linearly with n, and d scaling polynomially with n. Okay. Are there questions so far? Everybody good? Okay. All right. Okay. Let's continue. Okay, so I mentioned homological codes without actually defining them, so I will do this now. I will do this kind of sidestepping all the algebraic topology because it would kind of need me to kind of introduce a lot of definition and notation. I will just say that this is a general principle for constructing quantum codes using tools from homology, of course, and the recipe is very simple. The recipe essentially says take some tessellated d-dimensional manifold. Tessellated just means you kind of put some tiling on it, yeah, like this. Then we pick a dimension somewhere between 0 and d. And then we identify the constituents of the tessellation with qubits. And then the ones of dimension above and below with x checks and z checks. And I mean, we've already seen this. We've already seen this with the Torrey code, where we chose dimension, so we took a two-manifold, a surface, and we put our qubits on the one-dimensional guys. And this construction then tells us, okay, the checks are given by the two-dimensional guys, so the faces, and the zero-dimensional guys, the vertices. Okay, so this is just like some recipe to kind of turn something which is kind of geometric, topological, into a quantum code. And this is very nice because it kind of opens up a connection between these two. So first of all, if it's a tiling of uniform density, then certainly the number of qubits will scale with the volume of the manifold. The number of encoded degrees of freedom will scale with the closed submanifolds. So earlier we've seen the closed non-contractible loops in the 2D case. In high dimensions, this would be non-contractible, let's say if it's two, then non-contractible surfaces, volumes, depends on which dimension you choose. And the distance would be the minimum volume of one of these guys. Okay. We can do this in 3D. We can take a cubic tiling. We can decide to put our qubits on the edges, and then the checks are given by the faces and the vertices. A different choice would be to put qubits on the faces, and then the checks are given by the three cells, the cubes, or the edges. And this will always work. This will always commute, and therefore will define a sensible code. Note that in these two cases, the result will be the same because the cubic tiling is self-dual, so it doesn't change anything. But we can also do this in 4D, and then there's like a more canonical way of doing this. Namely, we can put qubits on faces and have our three cells and edges as checks acting on the adjacent faces. So this, you know, could be like a cube, and then the X checks are all the faces incident to an edge. So the question is, why would we even bother to kind of go into 4D? Like, why study 4D codes? The reason is that there are some additional constraints, local constraints, that the stabilizers have to fulfill. And actually, this turns out to enable very simple decoding schemes. So the local constraints are given by the vertices now. So let's say we look at a vertex, and now we look at all edges which belong to the vertex. Then we look at all the faces incident to those guys. So we just kind of take the product of all x checks which belong to a vertex. So again, the x checks are edges. And now we look at all the edges incident to one vertex. Then this has to give us the identity, yeah, and this gives us something like some kind of Gauss law for what the syndrome is. So let's say some error happens. Error happens on the qubits, which are two dimensional. So this will look like these kind of patches. Then the edge checks will have their parity violated at the border, at the boundary. So if an edge check is like in the middle here. It won't see anything, but at the border, it will kind of pick up the parity. And what we are seeing then, like the measurement outcome, will be like a bunch of loops. Since this is some extended information, we can kind of use this for performing local decoding schemes. And people have done this in the past. I would like to highlight that actually Hastings was the first to realize that this property, in combination with negative curvature, actually allows for very simple effective decoding. Okay. One more ingredient that I want to talk about is single shot decoding. So in 2D topological codes, the check measurements tell us something about the endpoints. So the errors happen on the edges, and then the parity is violated on the vertices at the endpoints of these chains. If the measurement is subject to error, which definitely is going to happen, then yeah, we can't kind of correct for this, just given the measurement outcome. So we have to kind of repeat our measurements to build confidence. This is different in 4D because of this local linear dependence. So we can kind of decode the outcome of the stabilizer measurement, and we only have to kind of do the measurement once, which is an advantage. And the first one to kind of look into this was Hector Bombin. Okay. So in order to kind of get to these like 4D hyperbolic constructions, let's first look at 2D. We look at negatively curved surfaces of increasing area. And these surfaces will have a large genus, so they will encode many, many qubits. Yeah, and they have a parity check weight kind of given by the tiling, but we will get to that. Okay. Let's kind of consider regular tessellations, so tessellations by regular polygons. Let's say R is the number of sides of a single face or tile, and S the number of tiles around a vertex. We can kind of subdivide these faces into triangles like this. So if it's a hexagon, we kind of just cut it along planes of symmetry and look at the triangles with their internal angles alpha, beta, and gamma. Then there's a condition on what these angles can be, which depends on the curvature of the space. In particular, it tells us that a plus b plus gamma has to equal pi if there's zero curvature. So this is the Euclidean case. And it has to be larger than pi if the curvature is positive, or smaller than pi if it's negative. Yeah, so in particular, let's, for example, for the Euclidean case, if we take this, then there's a condition on R and S, because these angles will all be the same for a regular tiling. Yeah, and we can kind of solve for R and S and see which R and S satisfy this. And then we see that for positive curvature, there are five solutions, which correspond to the five platonic solids. So if you kind of flatten this out, you would see that this is actually a tetrahedron and an octahedron and a cube and a dodecahedron and an icosahedron. For the flat case, there are three solutions, so the square grid, triangular grid, hexagonal grid. But for hyperbolic, there are many, many solutions, yeah, because this only has to be smaller than pi. So we can kind of make R and S as big as we like. So one way of thinking about this conceptually is kind of the negative curvature allows us to kind of cram in way more faces than Euclid would us allow to do. Okay, so the encoding rate is a consequence of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which tells us if we integrate over the curvature, then this is given by 2 minus 2 times the genus, so the number of handles of this closed surface that we're integrating over. The genus is given by 2 times the first homology, so the number of non-contractible loops, so each handle kind of has 2 loops kind of running through it. And by solving this, then we obtain the number of encoded a formula for the number of encoded qubits given by R and S. So if we increase R and S, then we include more and more qubits. But this also means that each face has more edges around its side, and each vertex has more edges. So this means we kind of increase the weight of the parity checks. There's some kind of trade-off. Okay, what about the size of these loops, which are the logical operators? So there's the notion called injectivity radius, which is the largest radius of a ball that can be embedded with all different dissections. In hyperbolic space, the radius of this ball will be logarithmic, and the way you can kind of think about this is that hyperbolic space kind of locally looks kind of tree-like. Not in the sense that there are no cycles, because there are plenty of cycles, but in the sense that if we have a tree and we kind of go down the level, then we kind of see more and more nodes. And similarly, if you kind of travel in one in some direction, then you see that kind of space is kind of branching out. So similarly, as in a tree, the number of levels is logarithmic in the number of vertices. Here, the radius is logarithmic in the volume. Okay. Yeah, and one can show that if we do this, if we kind of define a code from this, then like the D will be upper and lower bounded by some logarithm. Are there questions so far? Please. No questions? Okay. Okay, let's quickly go through how to actually kind of construct these 2D examples, and then from there it will be we will see how to do this in 4D. So in Euclidean space, we can take translations, let's say in the square grid, and we can identify points which differ by this translation. By doing this, we kind of get this infinite tube. And by doing this then again in the other direction, we get a torus. In the hyperbolic example, we can do the same thing. We can kind of use groups of translations, which are subgroups of the symmetry group of the tessellation, and they kind of serve as somewhat like non-commutative coordinates. And By identifying these triangles with the group elements, we can kind of wrap the space around. So similarly, as we have seen in the Euclidean case, we can kind of get finite examples by taking a suitable set of translations and modding them out. Okay, let's go to high dimensions. So let's say in 3D, there are four regular tessellations, which look like this. It's not so important, just I want to show you that you can kind of see how space kind of branches out. In 4D, it's very hard to visualize, so I'm only going to talk about the constituents. There are five regular tessellations. We will focus on one particular one, which has this name, 5335. And this is a tessellation by something called the 120 cell, which is a four-dimensional polytope with 120 dodecahedra. And to understand this picture, imagine how you would draw a 3D cube in two dimensions. So you could kind of take one face and you kind of make this big, and then you kind of draw the rest of the cube inside this one face. And then you obtain this kind of picture. And this is essentially what this is trying to show. So you take one of the dodecahedra at the boundary, make this big, and then project everything else inside. A kind of similar thing that we have just seen for 2D also holds in 4D, or generally in any dimension, called the Chern-Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which tells us that if we integrate over the Pfaffian of the Levi-Civita curvature form, then this will be given by the alternating sum over the dimensions of the homology groups. Again, so the homology groups are the non-contractible submanifolds or equivalence classes of that. Again, we can kind of try to kind of throw this into our recipe for homological codes. We can't exactly solve now for the dimension because there's the first and the third homology group, which we don't know. But we can just ignore them and we get a lower bound. And this gives us that K is lower bounded by N. So we get a linear code. And in our work, we show that actually the constant here is given by 13 over 72. For this particular tiling, using some combinatorial argument. Importantly, we've seen earlier that the injectivity radius is this logarithm of the volume, and this actually holds in high dimensions as well. But what kind of saves us compared to the 2D case is that the volume of a non-contractible I cycle is actually lower bounded by an i-dimensional ball of injectivity radius. And it turns out that this is actually an exponential in R. So it turns out that actually two dimensions is just like the edge case where it kind of goes wrong and we kind of only get a logarithm here. But actually, in all higher dimensions, if we kind of plug in this logarithm here and I is bigger than one, then yeah, we get a polynomial lower bound. Okay. Any questions? Okay, then let's move on. Yeah, Guth and Lobotsky showed that for a particular case of hyperbolic manifolds, actually this epsilon is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.3. But this actually doesn't hold in general. So it's kind of unknown what the epsilon is for a general class of manifolds. We can kind of try to use the same construction as in 2D. So meaning that we kind of subdivide things into the analogon of high-dimensional triangles. And we use translations to kind of identify them and then yeah, wrap things around. We can do this in one case, and we get something which is a code which has 144 physical qubits and 72 logical qubits, but which only has distance 2. So this is kind of a not very interesting example because distance 2 essentially tells us that we can kind of see that an error happened, but we cannot correct it because we don't have enough information. Yeah, so we can do some exhaustive search and some randomized search, and this gives us a few more examples, but this is essentially not scalable. So the scalable method is based on representation theory, and let's kind of first describe like the dream scenario of how this could work. So let's say we have some representation of our group in GLN over the Z. So with invertible matrices with integer entries. Let's say we take some element, some represented element, so some row of some element in G, and we just mod out a very large integer. Then we might imagine that this kind of this element won't be affected locally by this if n is large enough, but globally it will certainly be an will turn this into a finite group. Yeah. So we kind of use our representation, and then we kind of do this modding out of n, and then certainly this image is smaller than infinity, and then we kind of know that the manifold that we get will have finite volume. Okay, is everybody on board with this? Okay, the way to kind of get this this representation. Is essentially by embedding a hyperbolic space into Minkowski space. So we can identify points in Minkowski space and kind of equip it with a hyperbolic distance function. So these are hyperbola for the 2D example. The symmetry group of this is called the Autochronous Homogeneous Lorentz group. So these are generated by people who are familiar with special relativity will kind of recognize this because these are all rotations and boosts of special relativity, and this group is denoted in this way. And what we did essentially was we changed the Gram matrix of the inner product in this Minkowski space to respect the tessellation. Yeah, so be kind of commensurable with like normal vectors on the planes of symmetry. And we can do this, and we kind of get this Gram matrix. This Gram matrix then kind of defines these the reflections along these high dimension triangles, which we then kind of use to define the translations. You see that's like this is not really an integer matrix. There's this phi hanging around, and this phi is the golden ratio. The golden ratio pops up because tessellation, the faces of the tessellations are pentagons. So it's kind of natural that this shows up. So therefore, these matrices will certainly also involve this phi. Which kind of throws a wrench into our dream scenario where we wanted to have only integers as coefficients of the matrix. But we can just kind of pretend that phi is also, we just kind of add it to the integers essentially, and we get this Z adjoined phi. So now there's like two slides which are very involve a lot of algebra. So this is like for the experts. So let's kind of power through. The factoring out of this number is now has to be substituted by factoring out a maximal ideal of this so-called ring of integers adjoined with phi. And then we hope that we know that if this is a maximal ideal, which is you can kind of think of like some kind of subring in some sense, we get a finite field. And since this is finite, we know that the coefficients in the matrix will be finite. And therefore, again, we're kind of good. We kind of constructed a finite group. We kind of work with, instead of working with this directly, we work at polynomials. So we have to kind of factor out the minimal polynomial of phi, which is x squared minus x minus 1. These ideals come in two flavors. So either generated by prime numbers or by prime numbers and some factors of the minimal polynomial if it kind of factorizes over FP. And this then kind of gives us our finite symmetry group. One nice thing is that under certain conditions, so under the first scenario where the ideal is generated by the by just a prime number, we know that the image of this representation and the modding out is a known group called GO5Q, which is the group of 5 by 5 matrices which leave bilinear forms over FQ by invariant. If this FQ is of characteristic larger than 2, then this decomposes in the following way. So there's like one group and then some semi-direct product and then C2, C2, just like the abelian group of order 2. And this is somewhat reminiscent, again, of what people might know from special relativity, because this is the same in the same way that the Otto Kronos Lorentz group decomposes, where the C2 times C2 here are reflections in space and in time. So time inversion and space reflection. And these are, this is the homogeneous Otto Kronos Lorentz group. Okay. But the good thing is that we kind of now have this the structure, and with this we can figure out what the size of the group is, and from the size of the group we can infer the number of physical qubits. Then, so we can have infer the number of faces in this manifold, or in the tessellation of the manifold, and this is some p to the kind of scales with p as some polynomial of degree 20. Okay, but this is somewhat constrictive because we have said we can now use these symmetry groups. So the end product will be very symmetrical, but we don't actually care about how symmetrical this manifold is. So in order to obtain examples which are less symmetric, but just kind of have more examples, we use something called topological coverings. So the famous example of this is we can take a circle called S1 here, and we can kind of map the real line, the infinite real line, onto the circle. This is kind of shown by kind of drawing this in like some kind of spiral, and then all points which are above a certain point on the circle are mapped onto the same point. Yeah, so we kind of wrap the real line around the circle. This is called an infinite covering, but we can also have finite coverings. So we can take, let's say, the surface, this torus, and map it around itself to kind of get a smaller torus. Yeah. And by doing this, we don't actually have to respect the symmetries, right? We can have, we can have take like some kind of thick torus and kind of wrap it around to kind of make a thin torus. Yeah, so there's more flexibility in this. That's the idea. And by using this construction with linear representations, finite representations and coverings, we obtain all these examples. Here you can kind of see either the symmetry group, which kind of defines this manifold, or if it's obtained by a covering, then we just say, okay, this is like a threefold covering by six, where six is like this guy. Okay. I've already mentioned this very small example which is not very interesting for the code construction, but it's kind of interesting historically because this is known as the Davis manifold, and the idea is that in a dodecahedron we can kind of take like opposing faces and identify them, and this can also be done for the 120 cell. So we essentially have a tiling of like a single tile, a four-dimensional tile, and we obtain a manifold. Okay, so the reason why I think these 4D codes are interesting is because of this observation by Hastings that you can kind of use these very, very simple decoding methods. And what we do is we throw a very common one onto this, which is called belief propagation, which is a very widely used tool in classical LDPC codes. The nice thing about this is it has very low computational complexity. So essentially, there's a message passing algorithm where like small messages are sent from the qubits to the checks and vice versa, and each check then kind of updates its belief, every qubit kind of updates its belief of being in error, and we kind of expect this to work well because of some properties that this this code has. So the small loops inside this this graph given by the checks and the qubits has large girth, so like the small cycles are quite large. Also, this kind of expansion property helps, and the qubit degree, so the number of checks acting on a qubit is 5, and these are all like heuristics which kind of indicate that this might work well. And we did the numerics, and actually it turns out to actually do work quite well. These are some examples of codes, and you see that for p lower than, I don't know, certainly lower than 4, you see like nice suppression of the errors. If we now introduce noise into our measurements, then this kind of goes recedes a little bit, but not by too much. So this is also kind of like around 4. I kind of hesitate kind of calling this a threshold because essentially it's numerics, and it's very hard to actually prove that belief propagation would have a threshold because it has very complicated internal dynamics, and this cannot be easily simplified for a threshold proof, which usually kind of essentially just I only know of like threshold proofs which essentially exploit percolation theory. So this is not easily adaptable. Okay, we can also increase the number of rounds to kind of see that this doesn't kind of recede too much, and it actually doesn't. You see if we kind of increase the number of rounds without, so this is like one round constitutes measuring the syndrome or doing the check measurement and kind of correcting it and then kind of adding new errors and so on. Okay. Are there questions about this? Please don't be shy. Okay. Then let me go on. So with this, I kind of wrap up the 4D part. There are two open issues. So one is that we used a vanilla version of BP, so we don't actually kind of adapt it to this quantum scenario. We just kind of use like the off-the-shelf BP. So it's very, very likely that this result can be improved, actually. The second one is, I think, like the biggest drawback is that the stabilizer weight is relatively high. So the stabilizers are these dodecahedra. So they are weight 12, which is still lower than some other codes which have been proposed, but it's certainly not great. So the former issue can be kind of be fixed by modifying the BP decoder. But now I will kind of discuss some preliminary results tackling this problem. Okay, so clearly people have kind of thought about this in the past. Matt Hastings has some nice work on reducing the stabilizer weight for an arbitrary stabilizer code by associating to it a 2D cell complex. So like something like a 2D manifold, but which doesn't have to be a manifold in the sense that it doesn't have a well-defined local dimension. And he performs some local operations on this. And then he shows that actually this can be used to turn something which is non-LDPC into something which is LDPC. And if we kind of now do this in like some kind of controlled way, we can kind of still preserve the code parameters. In practice, I kind of checked, the checks turn out to be finite, but constant size, but they're still quite large. In particular, if you kind of just kind of apply this to these like 4D codes. Okay, so we will follow an alternative strategy, which is using so-called subsystem codes. And the idea is that we can take our stabilizer checks and kind of break them up into smaller pieces, so-called gauge operators. And these gauge operators do not commute necessarily. So generally, they won't. Measuring them, therefore, will give us random outcomes. But their product will correspond to a check measurement or a stabilizer measurement. One example is the back and shore code, where we have this grid layout of qubits. Our stabilizer checks are these like two columns or two rows. And then we kind of break these up into these like weight two checks, which are these gauge operators. Another example is the 3D gauge color code, which kind of works in a similar way that we have these kind of large high weight stabilizer operators, but they can be kind of broken up into lower weight checks. But these are just kind of like known examples, but there's, as far as I know, no general method of turning a CSS LDPC code into a subsystem code. So let's kind of, I know, let me give you like the flavor of how this works. Let's say we are in 2D, and let's say we have some check which corresponds to a face, and we take two, so this is a Z check, and this would be like X checks on the vertices, and this is a hexagonal face. And let's take these two guys, and we have just kind of identify them. So we kind of pinch this hexagon, and we obtain a bow tie. Yeah, but we still consider this to be one face. Yeah, that's important. So if we are in some hexagonal tiling, yeah, we can do this locally. Kind of pinch, and we get a bow tie. Okay. Notice that all stabilizers still commute, so this homological construction doesn't care about this. But do note that something strange happened. So I told you that the number of encoded qubits is given by the number of physical qubits minus the number of independent checks. Yeah, but now we effectively reduced the number of checks by one because we identified these two guys. So what happened? We must have kind of created some logical degree of freedom. And it's essentially this this loop here, like one side of the bow tie is a logical degree of freedom. And for those who are familiar with this homological construction, this is because this is not a boundary of anything. Because I still said this is still constitutes a face. Yeah, so the face only gives you like the full boundary. But this kind of local thing is not the boundary of anything. Yeah, so this is some, in some sense, a homologically non-trivial local loop. Yeah. And therefore, it's some logical degree of freedom. But because it's kind of small and localized, I will consider this to be a gauge operator. Okay. And yeah, this gauge operator, I can kind of I can kind of think of breaking up this stabilizer into these gauge operators. Yeah. So I said like this one, but certainly I can kind of apply the boundary here, and then I kind of get this this other side of the bow tie. Similarly, these operators kind of commute with every stabilizer, but you see that this guy doesn't commute with this guy because their overlap is one. Yeah. Yeah, they kind of form the x and z pair of this gauge degree of freedom. Are there questions? Somebody must have a question.
I don't have a question, but for the sake of providing feedback, so far the talk has been very clear.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks, I appreciate it. Okay. All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Then I will just continue. Okay, so we have these kind of gauge degrees of freedom, which we kind of created locally. So if we take a full hexagonal tiling and we kind of go around and kind of pinch each hexagon, we get this somewhat funky tiling of bow ties. So it's a bit hard to see, but I don't know, like here is one bow tie, and then there's another bow tie here, and then we kind of take periodic boundary conditions, here's a bow tie, and so on. Yeah, this defines a perfectly fine subsystem code. There's a way of kind of redrawing this, where we now kind of put so again the edges are the qubits, so we identified, we kind of put this now as, or we take our qubits to be vertices, and then it kind of looks like this, and this actually already appeared in the literature before, although not kind of through this construction. So this is work by Bravi and Tutlosi. Pula and Suchara, and they call this the weight three check Tori code, yeah, by this kind of merging and breaking thing, we turned weight six and weight three checks, so the weight six checks from the hexagon, into all weight three gauge checks. Okay. Yeah, this had nothing to do with hexagons or with 2D for that matter. So let's take some hyperbolic tiling. We can kind of do the same procedure several times. So we can kind of pinch it twice. So we can kind of pinch these guys, and we get this kind of clover. Let's say it's called clover, and we kind of go around and do this everywhere in our hyperbolic tiling, and we get this kind of picture. So this is like the hyperbolic version of this. And this is a new code, which is a linear rate code, because it's hyperbolic, which encodes like for every 9 physical qubits, it encodes 1 logical qubit, and it has weight 3 checks. Yeah. So now we can kind of increase the curvature, and kind of thereby increase the encoding rate. But we do not necessarily increase the check weight, which is now given by the gauge operators. Okay, this again kind of I said this has nothing to do with 2D or hyperbolic or anything. This is actually just like a property of LDPC codes, and the general procedure I just kind of hint to it is we take a single Z check, and we find a subset of the X checks, which overlap with this D check on some qubits, which constitute a cut. So there will be some kind of connected components of qubits here and there. And you see the like darkly shaded X checks. They kind of form like a cut between these two regions. Yeah. And by identifying these guys, I mean, it's kind of the same procedure, essentially. I mean, these might have, like, I know, more connections, and this might not be, there might be like several connections between these, but the general idea kind of works out. Okay. So the low check weight makes it easier to do the measurements, which is nice, because it's much easier to kind of, I know, do weight 3 checks than weight 6. Or higher. One more example is we can have errors on the gauge operators, and we won't care because the outcome is random anyway. And one thing that I didn't show, but which is true, is that the support of the logical operators of this code is unaffected. But this comes with an asterisk. The support of a logical plus the gauge operators is reduced. And kind of figuring out how this works has to be done on a case-by-case basis. But in the examples that I gave, and we have like some more small examples that we will put out, this is only given. This is like a factor of the previous check weight. I mean, this all sounds very nice, but keep in mind that we still have to kind of combine the outcomes of the small gauge operators to give us the outcome of the large high weight. Stabilizer generator or the check. So because of this, if there's noise on the gauge measurements, then this doesn't help us at all because we still kind of we don't expect any improvements in threshold from this essentially. Let's put it that way. Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with measurements errors. Okay. But again, there's something we can do. So in case the noise is somewhat biased, so let's say occurrences of that type noise is more common than X type noise, then we can actually perform gauge switching to improve things, so improve the threshold. Gauge switching has been used in the past to implement logical operators. So we kind of, I know, we change our mind about what we kind of constitute as a stabilizer. And we kind of, I know, by doing so, we kind of change our mind of what the code actually is. And we can do this here as well. So we can kind of add some commutative subset of the gauge operators to our stabilizer group. By doing so, we kind of, let's say we have to kind of, I know, do like several rounds of X measurements. We kind of gain more information about what Z errors occurred. And we kind of use our low weight checks, which we now consider to be stabilizers. And this is somewhat related to recent work by Tuckett, but they used like a different approach. Where they kind of really kind of change the code, and they don't use this gauge switching idea. Some preliminary results. Very naively, if we just kind of use unbiased noise in this Tori code version, we get a threshold of like slightly above 6%. Notice this is like the gauged version. And let's say we have a bias in our noise, and we can do this gauge switching where we can have preferably have like a bias of measuring the gauge operators in one basis, then we can kind of improve this to somewhere around like 15% or something. Again, this is like So this is for the hyperbolic codes. So here the threshold is like sub 1%. And then if we have biased noise, we can kind of crank this up to like 8%. If we introduce syndrome noise, this kind of goes down somewhat. So here it goes down to like 4% for the Tori code from 6%. And here it goes down from 8% to like 3%-ish. But this is still very, very much on the level of phenomenological noise. We are currently doing the full gate-based error model, where we kind of take the small details of how the how the measurement is done into account. OK, so let's summarize. We have construction of a 4D hyperbolic code family. We found several four-dimensional hyperbolic manifolds, many of which haven't, to our knowledge, occurred in the previous literature. So a few of them, as I said, the Davis manifold has occurred. But the other examples, and there are a few more examples in the differential geometry literature which showed up. We gave a code family which has a roughly 20% encoding rate. And we showed that by using this very simple decoding algorithm, we, under noisy syndrome, single shot error correction, we got results which are consistent with a threshold of 4%. Yeah, and these preliminary results on LDPC subsystem codes showed that we can kind of locally merge and break checks to turn them into gauge operators. By doing so, we kind of balance our check weights and construct these low check weight, but maybe even like linear distance quantum codes. And we showed that gauge switching can improve the performance once noise is biased. Yeah, and with this, I would conclude. So the work on the 4D hyperbolic codes was done together with Vivian Londe of INRIA, and the LDPC subsystem code construction is joint work with my PhD student, Oscar Higgett. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. Are there questions? There haven't been any during the talk.
Yeah, I've got a few questions over here. So first, with your family of these 120 cell codes, yeah. Do you have a handle on what the distance is for the various codes in the family?
Oh, yeah. So I didn't talk about that so much. So there's no analytic expression. As I said, so for some examples, there's this lower bound, which was given in the Goose-Lobotsky paper of n to the, do we have like a, so they kind of show that, So this kind of holds that this is order n to the 0.01. But actually, so they use these arithmetic hyperbolic manifolds. And from 2D, you can kind of see, although this is like not a proof or anything, but in 2D, it's certainly true that these arithmetic manifolds are not the ones which give you the particularly high distance. So long story short, I don't know the expression for this. And we only looked at like for small examples, as I said, like the Davis manifold, you can show that the distance is 2 because it's just like a repetition code. But then I think we have some examples of distance 6 and 12.
Cool, thanks. And then I had a few questions about the subsystem code part in the second half.
Yeah.
So first off, can you always like map from your subsystem code to the stabilizer code with like local kind of Clifford circuits to do like, if you're imagining doing these transformations with some CNOTs and ancillas and stuff like this?
I would think so. So I mean, essentially, all you are doing is this kind of pinching move. You don't even change the number of you don't even need ancillas, right? You kind of, I know you didn't you didn't change the number of qubits, right? I think so. Yeah, I mean,
cool. And just the last one. So you said about these subsystem codes that maybe I missed it, but if you break up the checks into these smaller things, but you still don't win anything with the threshold because you still have to reconstruct these big stabilizers. Yes. Is there any chance of doing something like you can do in the gauge color code where you can somehow do some error correction on the gauge operator outcomes? Or is that something that's not possible with these codes?
So you mean like just like using this like gauge switching, but just use it for like the 3D gauge color code?
I mean, in the gauge color code, you have like this thing where there's some conditions that the gauge syndrome has to satisfy, like the outcomes of the gauge operators, even though they're random, they have to satisfy some conditions because of like the flux of the different gauge operators has to obey some color conservation thing.
Yes.
Does this happen as well?
Oh yeah, sure. The outcome of the stabilizer measurement is still kind of reconstructed from the gauge operators. So that's like the whole point of this, that you can find out. You only have to have measure these like weight three checks. But from this, you kind of reconstruct like the full check of this this what I call the bow tie or the clover.
But is there in the gauge color code, there's also this thing where not just that happens, but there's also some other kind of there are other conditions that the outcomes have to satisfy, not just the stabilizer, not just that they multiply to the stabilizers.
So I'm not sure what you mean. So I mean, like it's somewhat. I mean, it's the same thing in the 3D gauge color code, right? That I see your point. Yeah, no, I don't know. I'm not sure. There's something like that. You know, this kind of like. I guess if you would look like at the 4D example of this, you would get something like some kind of like fluxes which have to be conserved. But this is then due to this local linear independence, local linear dependence that you just have from like the 4D homological code. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Like this kind of Z2 flux which has to be kind of conserved, which kind of has to go around. But then if you kind of break up the stabilizers, then there would be like a condition similar to the 3D gauge color codes, I would imagine, without having this checked at all. Take this with a grain of salt.
Okay, but then the 4D would probably work, but maybe not in the 3D or 2D.
It's different from the color code, I think.
Okay.
Again, without having checked any of this, this is guesswork.
Okay, Thanks.
Yeah.
So sorry, I had some local distractions for the first half of the talk. When you showed up the specific examples of codes in your family, I didn't quite get a chance to examine it enough. It looked like the later ones were kind of unrealistically large.
Yeah.
For a long time. I didn't get really to look at the middle sizes and to see kind of where they fit. And
can you see my screen still?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me kind of. So I have a comment towards it. Okay, so here can you see, so there's 720, which I think has distance 6, which is not great given that the stabilizer weight is weight 12. But then I think the larger ones have weight 12, like the one with like thousands of qubits. But let me give like one more comment. We don't have to kind of take like the pure hyperbolic code. What we can do is, if we have a hyperbolic tiling, can you see what I'm drawing on the blackboard?
Sorry.
Let me kind of, I know, start getting to draw. Let's say we have a hyperbolic tiling. So this is like a tiling by squares, and this is like the Poincaré disk. What we can do is, we can take one of these faces, and we can have just put like a Euclidean tiling inside of each face. Yeah. So from some kind of small hyperbolic example, I can construct more examples by kind of diluting the curvature somewhat, if that makes sense. So I take one of these examples. Yeah. Let's say maybe this one, and I just kind of add some qubits into this in a controlled way. And by doing this, I can increase the distance, but I kind of keep the topology invariant, so I kind of still have the same number of encoded qubits. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So even though I agree, I mean these are kind of quite large numbers, but I can kind of make like a somewhat more finite tiling, and then I kind of spread this out a little more.
Okay, and so then the other question about these is, how does the actual performance go with the size? So that was, I guess, implicit in those graphs, but again, it's kind of a little hard to extract.
Yeah, right. So yeah, I apologize. I didn't put this onto like a log plot or anything. The reason is that it's a well-known issue of some classical linear codes that if I decode them with BP, then there's a nice region where we kind of see nice exponential error suppression. But then there's like some, okay, the curve goes down very very rapidly, but then it kind of flattens out, because then there are some I forgot what it's called, trap words, something like this, which BP cannot handle. So I think I didn't want to be like disingenuous, but kind of, I know, trying to imply that this is exponential error suppression. I do believe that it is somehow, but we don't have a proof of this.
I guess what I really was interested in was the question of, is there some code of kind of vaguely reasonable size that actually has good performance?
So like if I want to kind of compare this to like the surface code or something, like taking like a bunch of surface codes.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very interesting comparison. I would really like to kind of make this comparison, but I don't know how to do it in an honest way, because we have this like large checks. So I think we would have to kind of really look into like the circuit-based model. And then it's like a matter of, I don't know, how you kind of, I mean, the advantage of the surface code is that it's planar, right? So if you really think in terms of, so the way I kind of imagine this to work is, I don't know, if you want to kind of interconnect fridges, and let's say you want to kind of have a logical qubit kind of separated over several fridges, then I think you're kind of giving up on planetary anyway. I think then this might be very competitive, and then you kind of maybe compare them in using the same error model. But we haven't done this comparison.
I obviously. First of all, the geometry, obviously you have to give up on that. So
yeah.
Let's assume that you're working with photons or ion traps or something, right, where geometry is not such a big deal. And I obviously you haven't done the whole circuit based model yet, but I even just at a more basic level, I just want to understand, I suppose I've decided I want to use one of these codes. Mm-hmm. For the phenomenological model, what size is reasonable that I can still get kind of error rates that are and threshold that's kind of in the ballpark of what I'd hope for?
I'm not sure I can give you a satisfying answer to that. Because it kind of depends on like what is the ballpark you hope for, right? You can kind of set some logical error rate. So this is what we did for this like 2D hyperbolic codes is you kind of, I know, you fix an error rate that you're willing to have, let's say 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the minus 10. And then you can compare to like some copy, number of copies of surface codes, let's say. And then the comparison would be which one is more efficient in terms of the number of physical qubits that you had to kind of put in. Because the thing which one has to be careful with is this is a linear rate code, right? So if I kind of increase the number of physical qubits, I get more logical qubits. But this also means the logical error rate, which I give here as like logical error on any of the encoded qubits, also goes down, right? Hey, Pippin. So this is like the way to kind of compare these two things. So kind of, I know, fix the logical error rate, and then kind of look at how bad would the logical error rate be for, let's say, for like the 720, which encodes 184 logical qubits. There it is. So, like how much surface code do I need to kind of, I know, encode that many qubits given a certain expected logical error rate on these guys? But yeah, we haven't done this. Because then another issue is, of course, like these, like the BP is very, it's very nice. I mean, it's very, you don't have to do any minimum weight perfect matching. Probably you can, yeah, you can do this much easier. You can do this with single shot. It's just like a lot of, yeah, like doing this comparison, I feel it's very hard. And I think in the end, you might want to have like a particular architecture in mind, and then you can do the comparison in a fair way. But yeah, with being hardware agnostic and not knowing anything about what can be implemented, I think I know highlight what the advantages are, but I don't want to kind of make a comparison which doesn't make sense in the end. Is that fair enough?
Sure.
Okay. Are there any more questions?
Thanks for the nice talk.
Oh, thank you very much.
The slides are very pretty.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Nico.
Thank you, Nico.
Thank you. Okay, I will get going because I have to kind of get a plane out of this country. Right.
Yeah, please do.
Thank you. Bye-bye.